Reading for this evening is Galatians 3, 16 through 28. Galatians 3, 16 through 28. Now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say, and to seeds, as referring to many, but rather to one. And your seed, that is Christ. What I am saying is this. The law which came 430 years later does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God, so as to nullify the promise. For if the inheritance is based on law, it is no longer based on promise, but God has granted it to Abraham by means of a promise. Why the law then? It was added because of transgressions, having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator, until a seed would come, whom the promise has been made. Now a mediator is not for one party only, whereas God is only one. It is the law. Then contrary to the promise of God, may it never be. For if a law had been given which was able to impart life, then righteousness would indeed have been based on law. But the Scripture has shut up everyone under sin, so that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given those who believe. But before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to faith, which was later to be revealed. Therefore, the law has become our tutor, our lead to lead us to Christ, so that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor, for you are all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ. For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ.
It's announced, as Don pointed out, that Dan McClung was supposed to be speaking tonight. He called me early in the week and gave me a heads up that he was coming down with something. Then he thought he was going to feel all right. Then he called Friday, he could barely speak. So even when you get to feeling better, sometimes laryngitis sets in. So he's not with us this evening. So unfortunately, we'll continue on in our series. This is lesson four of the case for creation. And let me see if I can kind of meld our thinking with Justin's prayer. He prayed that, you know, we exercise like the Bereans and study the Scriptures. Unfortunately, it's not so much Scripture tonight as we're looking at the two models. But we're on an aspect of what God tells us to do. In the Psalms, I think 19 it begins, that the heavens declare the glory of God. So there's an aspect that the Bible points to as to evidence for God in the things all around us. Now the heavens, you know, what we view with a telescope, but even what we see through the microscope, you know, the Bible gets into. Romans 1, you know, the things that are seen are held together by things that are not seen. And so as we look at the comparison of the two models, either creation or evolution, we're going through various laws of science. This evening, the law of genetics, which we'll try to make as simple as possible. At some point, I just may give it up and jump on to the next, you know, portion, especially when we get to Mendel's stuff. It gets a little hairy. But keep in mind that we are looking at, you know, the things of God, things, they're not things taught of God. I know there's people, I've talk with them, who think that the gospels and the stars, and by looking at the planets and stuff, you can determine what God's will is, and that's not what God wants you to get out of it. It's, you know, that just shows His glory, His majesty, His power, and everything else. Not only in the heavens, but like I said, you know, even as we look, you know, that's what we're going to do this evening, look at the very tiniest of things and see just how marvelous they are. And how much they scream, you know, creation instead of evolution. In fact, I remember One time they interviewed Enrico Fermi, who was the head of the largest cyclotron on the planet. In fact, this atom smasher was so big that two countries had to go in on the financing of it. I think it had a diameter of 25 miles or something like that. And they thought, they're basically tearing up the atom, and all these wonders are going to unfold themselves. And so they ask him, what have you learned, from smashing the atom and all this? And he goes, actually, we don't have any answers. Oh, we got some more questions. So even the farther down you go, it's still a mystery. That things are put together by God, and we have to look at them with a careful eye in order to understand just how magnificent all things are made and designed by God. In Galatians 3:16, which Wes read, the context goes into the promises and the blessings, but it starts off with, he does not say into seeds as referring to many, but to one seed and to your seed, that is Christ. And even in this, there's something to be learned on a physical level. The language of the Bible is like usage anywhere. There are times when it expresses its ideas in the understanding of the people it is written to. What we mean by that is, although it is not scientific to place the emotions in the vessel recognized as the heart, it is still the way people apply these things. They feel things in their heart. They feel it in their visceral regions. That's where they're impacted, and so that's where we think the things come from or refer to them, although now scientifically we know it has its origin probably in the mind and the brain. But the Bible can also be very scientific with its use of terms. I mean, the word seed might seem quaint as they're talking about it, but we ourselves, as we increase in knowledge to a point where we can recognize just how exacting God is. I mean, we may think, well, he's just looking at people as almost like a crop, seed planted. But no, he's being very scientific. An example can be seen in the use of seed. In his presidential address to the British Association for the Advancement of Science, William Bateson made this startling admission. He said, descent used to be described in terms of blood. We talk about our bloodline and all this. Truer notions of genetic physiology are given by the Hebrew expression seed. If we say he is the seed of Abraham, we feel something of the permanence and indestructibility of that germ which can be divided and scattered among nations. It goes along with not only what we're actually talking about in reproduction, but also in a promise made to many nations based on this. It remains recognizable in type and characteristic after 4,000 years. That is, we can still see people that are the seed of Abraham. It's in the genetic code. Almost 100 years later, though scientists grope to describe it differently, like faithfully copied or perfect replica, recurring pattern of reproduction, they still have not gotten any more precise than saying that all living things produce after their kind, the way Genesis starts it off. This lesson will demonstrate that the study of genetics has not destroyed the creation model, but really it's one of those laws of science that actually bolster the creation concept and tear down the model of evolution. Okay, first of all, the genetic code and Mendel. It is recognized by molecular biologists that the genetic code is universal. This thing that we've looked at, in fact, I think it's Linus Pauling who came up with the helix and stuff like that. It is in all things. It's a universal building block. Irrespective of how different things are in their external appearance, they've all got the genetic code. Renowned British geneticist E.B. Ford, in his book Understanding Genetics, provided an insightful summary in this regard. He said, something must be handed on from parent to offspring which ensures conformity. Not complete, but in a high degree, and prevents such extreme departures. Like another way of putting it, generally, you know, like does produce like, not photocopied, you know, kind of thing, but so close. You know, I remember pulling up to a gas station. My dad knew the guy that operated the place, and the guy looked at me and looked at my dad and said, "You can't deny he's your offspring." You know, just too much similarities, too close. Like producing like. Nor do we see anything coming up with radical differences, which the evolutionary model argues for, but the science doesn't back up. What it is, he says, how does it work, what rules it obeys, you know, why does it apparently allow only limited variation? I mean, there's a lot of rules right here laid down. You know, it reproduces, but within boundaries. Genetics is the science that endeavors to answer these questions of how it works, you know, what rules it's obeying. I mean, rules in a genetic code that it can do some things, but it can't do others. It has to obey the rules. Why? Gregor Mendel, the father of genetics, was, of all things, an Augustinian monk. There's a lot of things, you know, that we take as science, you know, they try to get God out of the picture, but a lot of things were developed by people that were God-fearing or had the time to experiment with this stuff, like Mendel did. If you've ever taken a class in economics, you'll find out that little balance sheet that you do where everything on one side has to be balanced by, that's another product of a monk. Yeah, if you've ever waded through that tedious thing, some God-fearing people have come up with some very useful things for our lives. In 1857, he began a series of experiments in the garden of the Abbey in Brunn, Austria, using edible peas. His accomplishments in the field of genetics are comparable to that of Newton's laws in mechanics. By the way, you know, his work sat on the shelf for 35 years, nobody paid any attention to it. You know, finally, somebody discovered it, dusted it off, realized, yeah, we got scientific, you know, foundation here. Mendel's laws are summarized as follows. I'm not going to go through all of these. I'll refer you to your, you know, biology book. It's probably in there with a lot of glossy pictures and stuff, you know, explaining all these things. But primarily, the inheritance of traits is determined by genes. That act like individual physical particles rather than fluid. Genes come in pairs for each trait. The genes may be alike or they may be different. When genes controlling a trait are different, one gene is obviously dominant and the other remains hidden or recessive. When you get a lot of, you know, in the family of, you know, black-haired, you know, green-eyed people, and suddenly you have an offspring that's, you know, blue-eyed with red hair, you go, yeah, that's the recessive gene, you know, finally cropped up. In gametes, eggs, and sperm, only one gene of each pair is present, and the fertilization results in predictable ratios. Okay, this is what he laid down as the laws, the rules the genetic code is following. There's more to it, but I'm not going to go into it. So as we look at what we call the fateful reproduction controversy, at least two important points make genetics a controversial subject in the creation-evolution debate. First, the genetic code's chemical instructions are copied faithfully, time after time. That is, sparrows never produce robins, buttercups never produce tulips, human beings only produce human beings. That's what we observe. That's what we've always observed. This is what Mendel observed. It must be a law. Okay? It's been accepted as scientific law for hundreds of years. Okay? Second, the genetic code with its complexity, orderliness, and function provides the most powerful kind of evidence for intelligent design. Okay? That things just don't happen, especially out of character, away from laws and everything else. That requires a designer. So we're saying the law of genetics really argues for God. And we'll show you, really why some really interesting concepts in the law. We will further examine these two concepts briefly. First of all, John Gribben himself, an evolutionist, has admitted that once a fertilized single human cell begins to develop, the original plans are faithfully copied each time the cell divides, a process called mitosis, so that every one of the thousand million, million cells in our body and in yours contains a perfect replica of the original plans of the whole body. Kind of the basics of Jurassic Park. You find a little dinosaur blood with some DNA in it, and make a whole dinosaur out of it. A little far-fetched still, but that's what it's trying to get across. Nobel laureate F.H. Crick has said that if one were to translate the coded information in one human cell, that is, just take one little cell, from your body and look at it under a microscope, and really look at it where closely, where you can see all the information that it holds in order to reproduce. Look at this. It would require 1,000 volumes each of 500 pages to do so. That's how much code is in that one little cell. Go through it. 1,000 volumes of 500 pages each. That's a library. It gets better. And yet, the mechanism of the cell can copy faithfully all this information in 20 minutes. A man and his computers can't even do that. Neo-Darwinism resides in the face of this. That means, this theory of the new Darwinism, basically says this isn't true. It defies the science, the rules that are laid down. The new neo is the genetic mutations that they want to come up with. I think we're going to get into it a little later more so. But mutations are the ultimate raw materials of evolution, according to George Simpson. Currently, it is thought that evolution proceeds through the combined efforts of natural selection and genetic mutations. However, the true facts of science tell a story not in accord with evolution. In fact, these two things, natural selection and genetic mutation. Survival of the fittest. Now, if you got the handout, it says survival of the fittest. I caught it, but not in time. It's one of those things. It is a word, fitness, and the computer is not going to tell me that I messed up again. Okay, even when I checked it and wrote out fittest, I realized, no, there's a T on the end. It's not two S's. I had to go back and change it to, and then something else was wrong. And there's two T's, in the fit, and then a third T at the end. So this thing had to go corrected, four times before I got it right. So I'm just letting you know, what you've already discovered anyway. I am fallible. In fact, I tell people it's not, will I ever make a mistake? It's find the one I made this week. Look at your sheets as a where's Waldo? Where's the mistake this week? The survival of the fittest, natural selection, is arbitrary and circular. Notice the fittest breed more, and the one who breeds more is the fittest. One guy used an example anyway of what does it mean by fittest? Say if you've got two bucks fighting over a doe, and they're going at it, and they're butting heads, and and trying to discover who's the machoest or alpha male in order to get the doe. And while they're doing that, another one kind of sneaks up, reproduces with her, and then sneaks off. Who's the fittest? Who finally got her? So it's things like that they really haven't figured out yet. Second, mutations are known to be random, destructive, and lethal. We'll get into more of it, but the mutations that we have on a record, like you can look at, look at this fly has three wings instead of two, or six legs instead of four, or however many flies have, but it's still a fly. It hasn't mutated into something else. And generally, as we'll see, mutations have never been beneficial. They've always been detrimental. You know, even when you successfully cross something, you know, like a horse and a donkey and get a mule, the mule can't reproduce. Mutations are, you know, not the answer, and they know better. In fact, natural selection should serve only to weed out these things. Pierre Paul Grassi, which we've already introduced, France's leading zoologist who held the chair of evolution at the Sorbonne for 20 years, said in his opinion, the opportune appearance of mutations permitting animals and plants to meet their needs seems hard to believe. You know, this is the head evolutionist. Miracles would become the rule. And they think, yeah, I mean, we believe in miracles, you know, in the creation model, but we don't rely on them. You know, evolution does. Events with an infinitesimal probability could not fail to occur. There's no law against daydreaming, but science should not indulge in it. So he's talking about, you know, for mutation to be, you know, the answer to this, he's saying it's daydreams, it's science fiction. Mutations are very rare, 1 in 10 million. Worse, evolution requires a series of related mutations. A mutation upon a mutation upon a mutation. So how do you even know if it's a mutation or not, if everything's mutating? The odds of 4 in a series would be 1 in 10 to the 28th. Okay, that's 1 with 28 zeros. I don't even know what that number is. I mean, I lose it beyond trillion. Also, mutations that can give rise to something different, underline this, are unknown in biology. So even when you see a mutation, it's still a fly. Okay. Unknown in biology. Okay, design of the genetic code. Now, this is the last section, I think. Okay, stay with me, because this is the best part. I mean, I really like this. Even what evolutionists would term simple cells, that is, the bacteria, have extremely large and complex libraries of genetic information stored within them. The genetic code is characterized by orderliness, complexity, and adeptness in function. As Dr. Wilder Smith explains, it resembles a hypothetical architect's plan of a house, which plan not only contains the information on how to build the house, but which can, when thrown into the garden, build entirely of its own initiative, the house on all of its own, without the need of contractors or other outside. I mean, picture it. I used to work with blueprints. Custom million-dollar homes, 60 pages of blueprints. But he said the genetic code is like one of these, that you take it out into the vacant lot and you put the blueprints down. Now, I know the blueprints are just, you know, that's it. That's what you start with, and they get changed a lot, you know. But mostly it's the contractors looking at them, having to buy the building materials. That's coming from someplace else. You know, there's changes along the way. And then if you leave it, the house begins to fall in disrepair, you know, with time. Think of an architectural blueprint having the capacity of actually building the structure depicted. That is, you put the blueprint down, and the blueprint starts to build the building and builds it completely, furnishing all the materials. Who heard of such a thing? Not only that, but once it gets done, it maintains the structure in good repair and can produce an infinite amount of things just like it. That's the genetic code. It's fair to say that technology exhibited by the genetic code is orders of magnitude higher than any technology man has developed. I mean, we're talking, if it's evolution, that nothing is smarter than man. There's a little quip in there. That is, it all came from nothing, but that nothing had more brains to turn out, you know, the world around us and us than man has still to come up with in his own technology. I mean, the genetic code is incredible. You know, what a cell does, you know, is beyond our ability to copy or even think about how it would work. He concludes the DNA molecule is something utterly unique and had to have an unnatural or supernatural origin. The information in the DNA molecule had to have been imposed upon it by some outside source. I mean, basically, if we're talking evolution, that information had to be in the nothing that it came from. Or it's more practical to believe that an outside designer designed the code to put it into the DNA. The information in DNA is presented in code form, and codes are not known to arise spontaneously. That's what we know about codes. They don't just happen. They have to be designed. In fact, this is our last slide. A code is the work of an intelligent mind, E.H. Andrews. And the code is there. Now you've got to explain where it came from. And we think the creation model explains it better than the evolutionary model. What we do in presenting all this is just be a little bit more open-minded as you go into this world. We're talking about people that have a bias. Now, we're not putting down all scientists. I have a deep respect for a lot of scientists. The beginning of science is done by men who believe in God, and I hold my utmost respect. I mean, we're men that are trying to come up with a foundation of science itself where previously something hasn't existed. It's an incredible the amount of work they did, and there's a lot of people, in fact, as we've been looking through this series, although there are some that are so obviously biased, you know, the reason only that they believe in evolution is because they just don't want to believe in God. But we've also seen those scientists that are avowed evolutionists that still linger a doubt because the way, you know, their science pushes their mind, you know, into logically seeing at the end of all this process, you know, is a divine designer, you know, that needs to be there. And they kind of balk at it, but they still got to admit, you know, we're kind of in that area. And then there are, you know, scientists who turn out textbooks, you know, that laud the, you know, the brilliance of God, in that we do live in a cosmos, a orderly creation and universe that has to have a supernatural designer to it. And sometimes we have to remind ourselves of that. You don't necessarily have to believe in the paranormal, I don't, but that doesn't exclude the supernatural, because God is supernatural. He is beyond the normal nature of things. He works above and outside of and all the way through and everything else, you know, our world. As Paul said, in him we live and move and have our being. And we as Christians need to recognize that, to live it, you know, that our being is here and requires and needs to be sustained by our ever-increasing pull toward God, drawing near to him, to be more reconciled to our Creator. I found that the more I study the Scriptures, the more I look at the world around me, you know, the more convinced one has to be, you know, that there is a God, and it's foolish to try to deny his existence and to really not obey him, especially since shows himself to be a loving father and only wants what's best for us. There's no reason to argue against that. So if you'd like to, you know, commit your life to a service to God and the things that he can provide, not only in this life and the world to come. Please let us know what we can do to help as we stand to sing.